In Istanbul on Friday night, senior Iranian and United States officials are due to meet to try to de-escalate the crisis between their countries as fear of war hangs across the region. Senior officials from Turkey, Qatar and Egypt are also expected to attend. If no agreement is reached, says Trump, probably bad things will happen. Meanwhile, Iranians are mourning the lives lost in the failed uprising of the last few weeks. How many were killed? Iranian authorities say little more than 3,000. Other sources put the figure at more than 30,000. Joining me now from Fife is Professor Ali Ansari, a formidable expert on Iran. He is Professor of Iranian History and Founding Director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, author of 8 books on Iran over the last 25 years, and a frequent contributor to The Guardian and The New Statesman. Ali, welcome to Late Night Live.
Good to be with you.
What's America still demanding of Iran, and what are the chances that this could end in war?
I think the chances that it could end in some sort of military intervention and war are probably still quite high. And the reason why I say that is because even though we're entering into a period of negotiations, the two sides are very far apart with respect to what they want from these. The Iranians have scored maybe an early victory in actually having the negotiations at all, because it allows them a little bit of breathing space. It's obviously been a fairly torrid time in Iran, as you pointed out. I mean, I think the uprising that took place has really had a very, very damaging impact on the fabric of the country as a whole, and obviously the stability of the regime.
But do you think America would still sort of begin aggression if the Iranians, for instance, don't agree to limit its use of ballistic missiles, or to cease supporting proxy militias around the Arab world? They seem to be the two truly outstanding issues at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are several things going on here. I mean, one is obviously the nuclear file itself.
Yes.
And the Iranians are sending out, you know, fairly mixed messages as to what they will be prepared to do. Some of them are saying that they've had agreement to actually ship out all the enriched uranium. Others are saying that that's just a red line, which they won't do. And then, of course, as you quite rightly point out, we have the proxies and we have the missiles. There's also an additional demand, I think, which is in some ways a recognition of the state of Israel, which I think for the Islamic Republic would be impossible to do. But it's part of this process by which, if Iran wants to become a normal part of the international community, it needs to behave as such and to stop really being that determined revolutionary power. And that's why I think that, you know, that the problem will be is once they get into talks, the Iranians will definitely offer certain, you know, titbits, in a sense, to the Americans to keep them engaged. I think the other powers, Qatar and Turkey and others, will want to avoid any conflagration. But I think, as we saw back in June, by the way, I mean, talks can go on and Trump may decide that, you know, he's had enough of the talks and he's going to move towards actually a military confrontation. And we do know, of course, that assets are still being moved into the region. I mean, this is not a cheap or easy thing to do. So he's keeping all his options. He's keeping all his options open.
Is there any country urging America on?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because, I mean, the general consensus is obviously the Israelis might do it. But in actual fact, we now know that the Israelis probably tried to put Trump off initially, certainly until they were more prepared. So when Trump was initially interested in moving in, most of the region, including the Israelis, probably put him off. I don't think there's any particular love lost, I have to say, among any of the regional powers, Israel and the Arabs included, for the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think the problem is that they're very, very worried about the instability that might result from a military confrontation, which, you know, of course, the minute you get into that, you know, all cards are, you know, everything's, you know, everything becomes a bit open. We don't know what the end result of that will be. The Turks, I know, are extremely worried about refugees. Obviously, the Arabs and the Persian Gulf are very anxious about the economic stability that may follow. But the problem they have, of course, is that the situation in Iran is quite unstable as it is. The only way that Iran will get to some form of stability is to make the necessary changes domestically that it needs to do. And of course, this, the regime, has singularly failed to do. And it would be very difficult to see how they can make those changes without signing their own death certificate.
Would it be of any help at all to the protesters, the ones who want to overthrow the regime, for America to come to their aid?
I think the very serious issue here is that the protesters are expecting something. You know, Trump has, I think there's too much emphasis played on the fact that Trump told them to go out and demonstrate, to come out. I mean, I think they were going to come out anyway. I don't think, you know, Trump can be held responsible basically for getting them out, or anyone else for that matter. I think the anger and the fury in Iran is enough of its, you know, is a dynamic on its own. But there is an expectation now, because Trump did say those things, that, you know, help is on the way and we will do things. So I think at a very minimum, what Iranians would expect from Trump is, even if there is no military intervention, and I think many people are torn on that issue. I mean, that's the difference, although people are calling for it, quite a lot of people are calling for it, even within Iran. I think what the least they expect is that Trump does not offer the Islamic Republic a lifeline. And that's the key. It's not so much whether he's going to come in and support the protesters. It's whether he's going to offer the regime any form of sanctions relief, which would, you know, then give them a lifeline, as well as offering them a degree of legitimacy, because he's dealt with them, you see. I mean, this is the problem. And I think many, many people in Iran will see that as a massive betrayal. Not an unusual one, it has to be said. I mean, there are historical precedents for this going back 100 years. But nonetheless, it would make a difference, I think, if the West, and the United States in particular, paid heed to that domestic dynamic and was aware that, you know, they don't want to abandon really those Iranians, who I would consider to be in the vast majority, by the way, who don't want the regime to continue, certainly not in its current configuration.
How many people do you think died over the last few weeks of uprising?
It's very, I mean, the government itself has issued this remarkable figure of 3,117, which seems to be a recycled figure. I mean, it's a figure that they've used in other...
They've used before.
Yes, I mean, it's a recycled figure. Some people have noted this, and it's been noted on social media. Some people think it's a code word, actually, that it's not a real figure at all. I mean, 3,117 is meant to look as if it's quite accurate. Because it's obviously an odd number of one sort or another. I remember the days in the Green Movement when we had the great, you know, election fiasco and fraud in 2009, when they weren't quite sophisticated, and when they issued, you know, all the election statistics, it was so neat and tidy that people said that this clearly wasn't a realistic representation of what happened. I mean, there were no spoiled ballots or anything like this. Now they've obviously learned a little bit, but this figure has been used before. I mean, it's been used with COVID deaths and other things. So people are very, very sceptical of that. And of course, you know, most people assume that if the regime itself is saying 3,117, then it's at least double that figure. Now, what we have confirmed, I think, by various human rights organizations is indeed double that figure, about 6,000, going on to 7,000. But the problem is that there's a whole load of other deaths that are still being investigated. And there is a sort of an assumption, really, a consensus, I should say, coming out that we're certainly looking at five figures, that we're looking at above 10,000, probably heading towards 20,000. I can't comment on the 32,000 figure, although I wouldn't be surprised if eventually we reach that number, because, of course, they are also executing people as we speak. And, you know, one of the real atrocities that happened, obviously, over the uprising was that they went into hospitals and were shooting people in hospitals. So it's an extraordinary development, really, even in the history of Iran. And I think people need to really be acutely aware of that. This is not normal behavior. And while, you know, we've seen atrocities around the world, and many people are very sort of inured to this sort of stuff, I think in Iran in particular, there was never a sort of an expectation that the regime would act with such dramatic violence against them. And the way in which the brutality that was exercised was pretty appalling.
You made the point the other day in the New Statesman, and it really surprised me, that the overthrow of the Shah in 1979 was not as remotely bloody as this.
No, not at all. But that's because the Shah, of course, was not really I know they called him a bloodthirsty tyrant, but, you know, the one thing he probably wasn't was bloodthirsty. I mean, he You know, he was criticized very heavily for it at the time, of course, from both sides of the divide. I mean, people wanted him to be much more heavy-handed. Interestingly, the gentleman who did that research has now been on social media, you know, confirming the numbers that he did the research on, and then sort of saying, actually, I mean, this is what's quite interesting. He said, you know, we mustn't exaggerate these figures. He's settled on the 3,117, of course. But it's partly, you know, there are two reflections on that. One is that he cannot believe, actually. I mean, it's too much for him to believe that the Islamic Republic might kill more than the Shah. I mean, that's too hard for him to accept. The other thing is, of course, is that living in Iran, it's probably very difficult for him to say anything otherwise. It's interesting that many other people in the system are now breaking ranks and making very clear that what's happened is a national catastrophe. And I do feel that the regime itself, I differ with a number of people on this, that some people think that, you know, they've been highly effective in their use of violence. I think very literally they've indulged in overkill. I mean, it's so shocked wider society that rather than suppress the discontent, it's probably re-energized it. I mean, people are now thinking they have nothing to lose, and we have evidence that people are arming themselves now. So, I mean, it's, you know, we can expect, you know, new rounds of protest to emerge, particularly because the basic fundamentals, as I pointed out in that article, have not been addressed. And if anything, the economic situation in the country is getting worse.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to an Iran expert, one of the world's leading experts on Iran, Ali Ansari. Ali, let's go to the state of Iran, because, again, in that extraordinary article in The New Statesman, you point out what a decrepit wreck that country is. Sanctions, you argue, have made it worse, but it's not really sanctions. But the supposedly ultra-honest Puritan religious regime have looted the place.
I mean, that's right. I mean, it's an extractive state. It's, as I sort of argued in other pieces as well, I mean, they inherited a fairly rich and powerful state from the monarchy that preceded them. I think they did so principally, you know, quite cheaply, as we point out. You know, I mean, the level of casualties were fairly low. And, I mean, they just couldn't believe their luck. And I think since 1979, they've been spending down their inheritance. And the whole political economy of Iran is not shaped or defined by investment. It's shaped by the extraction of wealth, and the extraction of wealth through trade, principally. I mean, the exchange of goods. And the one variable, as I pointed out in the article, is the oil price. And if the oil price goes up, there's a lot more money to go around. And of course, that sort of disguises many of the problems, exactly as it did, you know, in the 1970s under the Shah. Of course, the situation there was a good deal more stable, principally because the Shah was surrounded by technocrats and officials that actually understood, you know, what they were doing. It still went wrong, obviously, for the Shah. But in this case, you know, the situation is, you know, on many, many, you know, many, many times worse. And the example I really bring is the environmental crisis. And this is something that we don't pay enough attention to. But there are mea culpas done by officials, actually, in Iran. And, you know, there are links in the article to the interviews where they say that, you know, what we've done is a national catastrophe. And one of them actually says that, you know, 7,000 years, I mean, that's his words, not mine, 7,000 years of Iranian civilization is coming to an end. Now, why does he make that claim? Because basically Iranian civilization on that plateau depends on the careful managing and harnessing of its water resources. I mean, Iran has been fairly lucky that has fairly abundant rainfall and water resources. But what they've done over the last 46, 7 years is they've drained those water resources. The population has almost tripled. They haven't invested in the water infrastructure in the way that they should have. And the water aquifers, you know, under the plateau are dry. I mean, as he says himself, you know, 20 years ago, you drill a well at 30 meters and you find water. Now you're having to drill down to 500 meters to find water. I mean, it's an extraordinary situation to be in. And I think that, along with the economic crisis that overlays it, I think it's the environmental crisis that is the real problem that underpins everything, but the economic crisis that overlays it, I think, is what will do for the regime. I mean, it you know, whether it survives politically is really dependent on the fact of whether it can manage the economy, and it simply cannot. I mean, it's going nowhere at the moment.
Is that what you think will ultimately bring the regime down? Economic confusion,
I
collapse?
I think ultimately, because I think the political the political challenge it faces. It's shown that it's capable of killing on a very wide scale. The opposition at the moment is not as united as it should be, even though it has rallied around the former crown prince. But its, you know, organization on the ground is not as sophisticated as it perhaps was even in 2009. But the, you know, the economic crisis is so bad. I mean, there are people now, even in Iran, who say very openly that the Iran is a failed state. You know, they basically say we cannot deliver the basics to our people. We cannot deliver oil, gas, water. Now, think about it. You know, Iran is sitting on the fourth largest reserves of oil in the world and the second largest reserves of natural gas. I mean, how is it possible that this country cannot deliver these basic commodities of which it has an abundant supply of to its own people? It's because it just has, you know, not planned, not invested, and, you know, neglected the infrastructure, you know, on many different levels. I mean, I tend to argue that, you know, we need to move away from the material investment and look at also the moral and political, you know, failures. There's huge, huge bankruptcy there, I think, as, you know, we see in terms of the corruption, which is both, you know, fed into the economic malaise, but is also a reflection of that economic malaise, if you will.
Strange that these religious figures could at the same time be so extraordinarily corrupt. You make the point that so jaded are Iranians with their religious regime that the country is now the most secular society in the Middle East.
It's yeah, I mean, it's more than that. It's almost, I mean, I use the term secular in that sort of Anglo-American model of, you know, saying separation of church and state. But, you know, there is also a strong element of atheism growing in the country. I don't think that Iran is necessarily going to turn into this, you know, vastly atheistic republic or anything. It's not on a French revolutionary model, certainly not yet. But you're seeing a huge, you know, reaction against organized Islam. And of course, you know, there's a huge anomaly here. Of course, there's a huge contradiction that young Iranians stare in, you know, sheer, you know, bewilderment at what goes on in Western capitals with all these marches and stuff. You know, there hasn't been the sort of enthusiasm for the Palestinian cause, for instance, in Iran, as there has been in the West. And part of this almost the entirety of this is the fact that they do not support Hezbollah or Hamas because they see these as wings of their government that represses them. And, you know, I've known recently talking to Iranians that they're aghast at this notion that there are people in the West, certainly in London, we've seen it, where people are chanting in support of Khamenei, for instance. I mean, it beggars belief to them. So, you know, we find in Iran actually a country that is moving in a starkly different direction than many other countries in the region. Ultimately, I think, in a very pro-Western direction. And I think that the West needs to be cognizant of this fact, you know, and you know, we're looking a gift horse in the mouth, if you will. I mean, and we mustn't turn it away. So I think there needs to be a much, much more properly thought out policy, really, from the West towards Iran, rather than the sort of reactive stuff that we've been seeing of late, where people, you know, really don't know how to handle it. I mean, they sort of fail to sort of see the writing on the wall and don't react to it properly. And then, you know, the problem is we lose yet another opportunity.
If the worst came to the worst, and if the United States did attack Iran, would at that point anybody join the United States in that attack? However reluctant they might be, however scared they are of the repercussions, could the United States strong arm allies to support them in such a maneuver?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's going to have to strong arm the Israelis. I think the Israelis will be very much, as long as they feel, you know, properly protected at their end. But, you know, for the Israelis, they see a change in regime in Iran in that sense as a huge, huge opportunity. I think the key will be what the Arab allies, certainly in the Persian Gulf, do. And my suspicion is the Arab allies will eventually buy into it all, because they'll see which way which way things are going. We have American bases in, you know, in Qatar and Bahrain, and I think in the UAE as well, there are the various assets. So the Iranians have already said that they will attack everyone. And, you know, the Iranian strategy is, you know, we go down, we take you down with us. It's a completely, you know, bizarre, nihilistic approach. I mean, it's obviously meant to deter. But again, it's one of those things where, you know, if that's your strategy, frankly, don't be surprised if all these countries then pile in against you, because, you know, if they're going to be under attack, you know, they're not going to sit there and, you know, they've built up a fairly sort of highly sort of advanced air forces of their own, they probably will use them. So, I mean, I think that's the danger. And again, it's this sort of idea that the Iranians have said they'll close the Straits of Hormuz. If they close the Straits of Hormuz, you know, of course, that affects them as well as anyone else. But I would also suspect that the Americans and others are taking preemptive measures to make sure that does not happen.
I know that you're a cautious and extraordinarily skilled academic analyst of this situation, Ali, but can you put a figure on it for us? What do you rate the chances of violence?
Oh, the chance of violence in terms of what? In terms of an attack?
In terms of an attack.
I think the chances are quite, I mean, I think they're over 50%, certainly. I mean, I think at the moment, you know, you're seeing a situation where they'll go into talks. The talks will probably drag out, I suspect. I mean, there may be, I think, initially, as we've seen previously, there'll be some sort of uptick initially. There'll be a little bit of optimism, and then people will start, you know, the Iranians will get comfortable in their negotiations. They will drag things out, and Trump will get bored. And the minute he gets bored is the danger point, really. And I think then, you know, the chances of something happening are going to be quite high. And I think people need to be prepared for it. Now, you know, ultimately, yes, it may be somewhat further down the line because of what's going on at the moment in terms of negotiations. But if last June is anything to go by, you know, Trump can behave, you know, can be quite spontaneous about these things. I think ideally he wouldn't, in many ways, the Americans would not want to go down that route. But these negotiations will probably make it explicit to everyone that, you know, the Iranians are not showing the sort of flexibility that I think even their regional partners would like them to show.
Ali, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Ali Ansari, Professor of Iranian History and the founding director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland.